So there are two ways that you could look at this scenario, and one of them, I think, is just what is objectively the best thing to do here from the perspective of an experienced pilot who kind of knows what's going on. And I think, Paul, you do a good job of laying out your case and your hopeful risk calculation, as you call it. But the other thing here is that this is a pilot that doesn't have all that background. This is a 50-hour brand new private pilot. And from their perspective, something is going on here. Maybe there's maybe a problem with the engine. There are lots of places that they could stop. So maybe on principle here, it is wise to just err conservatively, stop, call the flight school, check it out. Is it the same answer for you, Paul, if you can put yourself in the position of this pilot who just doesn't know on principle? Do you do something different in that case?
Well, that's why he's listening to pilot workshops. We are basically acting as the CFI in the right seat, flying along with him. So he or she will be prepared and will have thought out this kind of scenario. So it's kind of an upload of experience, if you will. And the larger point I would make has less to do with the technical aspects of potential oil flow than it does the what I mentioned as the fuzzy world of risk assessment when you don't have a lot of information, which in a 20-year-old warrior with the instrumentation you have, you just don't have. You're not going to get it. What you'd really want to know here is CHT. If we had CHT and we could see that the cylinders were pushing up well over 300, then we think, okay, this engine is really hot. But if they were down where they're supposed to be, you know, in the 280s or whatever is normal, really wouldn't worry about it.
Let me go to Tom here, because you do have a split in your answers between 2 and 3. And I think that depends on whether you're speaking for yourself or for the scenario pilot, right?
Yes.
Could you expand on that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, as a 52-hour wonder, if you had told me, first of all, he works in a software company, right, or flight sim development, which means he probably doesn't know much about engines. He probably knows a lot about electrons and circuitry, maybe, but he doesn't know much about engines. If you told me it was a gearhead, then I might make a different choice, because he probably would understand some of the things that may or may not be going on with the engine. But since we don't have that bit of knowledge, he's got 52 hours. His passengers so far have been having a great time. They're taking pictures and it's been a good flight. And it's like, hey guys, you know what? Some of these engine indications are just looking a little weird to me, and I think we should get back to the airport. We're just going to go back to Boeing Field, and we'll get you back on the train, and you guys can have a nice flight, or we'll get it quickly checked out. But we're going to go back to Boeing Field and land, because I'm seeing a couple things that don't look right to me. And I think that's relieves us a lot of stress from a 52-hour pilot who maybe doesn't understand some of the stuff we've been talking about, and then I'd probably consult with the CFI, and then he would tell me to go to the pilot workshop scenario that talks all about these kind of things where you can get all this wisdom.
Yeah, this scenario came from a story from somebody that we work with here who worked on Flight Simulator in the Seattle area and made this exact flight. And his answer was to kind of step climb his way to the destination, and it worked out fine. But he was uncomfortable the whole way because he just didn't know if this was normal. And I think his decision, as much as anything, was driven by, well, I've got passengers. How do I explain this? If I land and call and there's nothing wrong, this is normal, is that embarrassing? Should I know better? It's that sort of situation that I think a lot of new pilots or pilots that are just pushing their comfort level into some new experience can probably relate to. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's an important lesson that pilots need to understand, that sometimes you do have to say to passengers, hey, this isn't working the way we planned. It's either like, it could be that because of weather, we're not going to be able to make this flight at all today. Sorry, that's the way it is when you fly light general aviation airplanes. Or in this case, it's like maybe you get started on a trip and things aren't looking right, either from weather or mechanical standpoint. And you need to be someone who is prepared to disappoint your passengers.
Dave.
And your passengers probably won't be disappointed. It's like decisions, you know, made with an abundance of caution actually oftentimes will instill confidence in both the pilot and the situation. I say that even though I'm sticking with number 4 and step climbing and monitoring, and that too is a lesson that any new pilot is going to have to learn, and that is that, you know, there's some vagueness and lots of gray areas in general aviation where, you know, you can't necessarily diagnose and fix a problem or an apparent problem, you know, most of the time. So it's like you have to get used to dealing with some ambiguity.
Bruce.
Staying on that theme, though, of the new pilot, I think this is really important. He's only got, you know, whatever it is, 50 hours, 100 hours, but he probably doesn't have that much experience flying with passengers. And now we're into a classic situation where we've got the additional pressure. We always talk about this in your aeronautical decision making of how does carrying passengers change your decision process and put that pressure on you. So that's why I lean more toward number one. Let's get on the ground and sort this out. And I can also, I'll cheat a little bit with some local knowledge. There's a restaurant right by the control tower at Tacoma Narrow. So you could stop there, let your passengers go in and have pizza or whatever, while you then call the flight school or talk to one of the local mechanics. There are services there. And if worse comes to worse, the train that they were planning to take does stop in Tacoma. So they could get an Uber over to the train station and continue their journey that way.
Yeah. You guys hungry? I just got hungry. I think we should stop. Dave.
I was just going to say one point is that the local flight school is not necessarily your best source of information because they've got a stake in the outcome. You know, they don't want to get the airplane stranded. They don't want to be caught in an embarrassing situation of, oh yeah, we left the oil cooler restrictor plate in. I would maybe a little skeptical of the advice that they provide.
So who would you talk to?
I think the local mechanic would be a great source. Also, if this pilot has an experience with the 56 Buick that Paul mentioned, you know, that's going to be really valuable in this situation. And even though this is antiquated technology, you know, they're really like an oil pressure and oil temperature gauge. Those are actually super reliable because they're so incredibly simple. You know, and the fact that they're working in conjunction here, that it's like, you know, a rise in oil temperature is going to make the oil pressure go down a little bit, leveling the airplane, getting more cooling air through the oil cooler reduces the temperature. You know, I would have confidence in those indications.
So let's put some doubt on the indications. Let's say the oil temp now is off the charts high, you know, maybe on the peg, but it's beyond the red line. Oil pressure is normal, because now it sounds to me, I would suspect that that's probably a gauge issue, right? What would that say to you, Dave?
Well, yeah, I would reach the same conclusion that that's in all likelihood a gauge issue, but you know, out of an abundance of caution, I would, you know, if it's past the red line, I'm, you know, and I'm a 56 hour pilot, I'm landing. You know, but I just bring those up because, you know, oil pressure and oil temperature gauges, because of their simplicity, tend to be reliable.
Wally.
I think the point Tom made about whether the person is a gearhead or a techie probably would determine what they do in this case, because in doing private pilot check rides, I'd ask that question a lot about you have a high oil temperature indication, but your oil pressure is normal to see what their understanding of that system was. And I found mostly they didn't understand that relationship very well, that if it's really high, the pressure is going to be lower. And I think this pilot had a lot of clues that it was just a new day, a new airplane. He's never seen this particular airplane. He hasn't flown this particular airplane. It's indicating a little higher than he's used to. The temperature today is warmer than he's ever experienced. And the other clue is when he levels off and reduces RPM and adds some more airflow, the temperature goes down. So he can fix the problem. So sure, there's never anything wrong with going back to the airport or landing en route, but I think he's got enough clues to say, I can safely continue here and maybe get this diagnosed. I'll call back home, speak to the mechanics back there and complete my mission.
Tom.
Yeah, I think, again, for a lens of a new pilot, the idea that I may continue on and then I land at my destination and now I'm not sure. I haven't really solved the problem. Maybe I can find a mechanic to look at the airplane. Maybe I can't do it. Now I take off with a potentially troubled engine and try to get back home, or am I being stranding the airplane in a remote location? That sort of thing. It's just another thing that I think as a new pilot in particular would weigh on you.
Paul.
I think I'd caution against assuming a gauge error under any circumstances because you have no reason to believe that is or isn't the case, because you don't really have any countervailing indications and you don't have any means of cross-checking. So, and I agree with Dave. I mean, if it goes to red line or above, then I'm going to pull power back and land at the nearest practical airport, because those gauges are there for a reason. If we say on the one hand, they're so simple, they rarely fail, and then it does fail, or we see an indication we don't like and we assume that it's failed, there's a kind of counter logic going on there. So the only reason I continue in this scenario, because it hasn't reached red line, it's just high, and there are no other indications that it's truly an overheating engine, and I've got options, and mainly the directionality test works, and that's what gives me confidence to go on, even with all the other information being completely ambiguous.
Yeah, and these are required instruments for VFR flight too, right? So if you know that it's just a faulty gauge, you're supposed to land now. Bruce.
Well, that's a nice transition to what I was just going to say about the checklist. You know, it's in the resources here, and there is an actual procedure for high oil temperature. Now, it doesn't say red line. It just says high oil temperature. It says an abnormally high oil temperature. This is clearly that. It's not constant. We've already discussed that. But here's a new pilot. He's got a procedure in the checklist. A good lesson here is to review your POH or AFM and see if there are procedures for these types of situations, and then follow them. Again, he's not very experienced. Now, a more experienced pilot might be doing the experimenting we've been talking about and see if it resolves. But in this case, I think it's prudent either to go back to Boeing Field or, as I chose, just continue to the closest airport, Tacoma, and investigate the problem.
Yeah, and I think that's back to that fundamental question of the scenario is, what do you do with uncertainty? Because I think, you know, you're saying this is abnormally high. This pilot doesn't know that, right? They might look at that checklist or that expanded emergency procedure and say, for abnormally high oil temp, well, that's exactly what's got me confused in the first place here, is I don't know if this is abnormally high or not.
Right? Well, it does say that a steady, rapid rise in oil pressure is a sign of trouble. This isn't a steady, rapid rise. This has just been happening during the climb. We've already experimented that. But again, given this pilot's experience, I think it's wise not to fall into the trap of disregarding procedures in the POH for your airplane. Let's get it checked out, and maybe this is a great learning opportunity. I would certainly present this as a scenario during a stage check to a pilot and ask what they were doing and how would they handle the situation. And when there is guidance in the POH, let's follow that. That's your default position, is to follow that. And that's what all the ACS says about all of these sorts of any sort of task you're doing in the ACS. What does your airplane flight manual say, if anything, about this?
Steve?
I'm sticking with my pick of four, understanding that I think Tom really laid out, you know, here's my options if I am the 52-hour pilot. But another thing to do is, you know, check the electrical loads that are on the system for other stuff, especially your lights. For example, in at least a couple of aircraft I fly, turning off the landing light momentarily will materially change the engine gauge and, frankly, the fuel gauge indications and so on. Now, then you can ask yourself, was it correct with the landing light on, or is it now correct with the landing light off? Understanding those elements of the specific aircraft you're flying, and especially with those Piper 4 gauges. The other thing is, I would be remiss if I failed to call to the attention of the order that I think there's a pilot-friendly manual that will tell you many things about airplane engines, and one might be able to procure it from a fine supplier.
So many plugs for pilot workshops in this pilot workshops recording. Dave?
I think Bruce brings up an excellent point in, you know, consulting the POH, using the POH procedure. I just feel like in this situation, doing that is going to reinforce my decision to continue on number four. The plane's going to respond normally. The oil temperature is going to cool in level flight. And this young pilot is going to, the lesson that he's likely to learn is how to be comfortable being a little uncomfortable, because that's a normal state of affairs.
Paul.
Dave, question for you. Would you do the same thing if there were no airports en route?
I think so. You know, I think this is a situation to monitor closely. You know what? And the point you brought up about the gauges, you know, what occurred to me is it's like, okay, let's put aside for a moment the oil temperature and oil pressure. What if the fuel gauge, which is a really inaccurate one, what if suddenly it went to zero? You know, would the pilot, immediately treat that as a I'm out of gas situation and, you know, land the plane there? You know, it's like I wouldn't probably, but, you know, but once again, we're dealing with a new pilot. The points about, you know, the pressure on a new pilot with carrying passengers. This is one of the early experience carrying passengers. You know, I don't underestimate that. You know, no one likes to, to look panicky or foolish or, you know, lower our estimation in the eyes of our friends. But it's like, don't underestimate the pressure that this pilot is going to be feeling from, you know, from being in this situation. And the only guidance I would really have to offer there is, you know, just ask yourself, what would you do in this situation if you were solo? And try not to behave differently when you are flying solo than you would when carrying passengers. You know, there should be sort of one standard for that.
Well, there's a lot of what ifs we can do on this scenario, and I'm curious to get a feel for whether people's choices would change if the scenario changed a little bit. I'm going to start with if you had much better instrumentation. So you had a good engine monitor. What might that tell you that would cause you to change your decision here, realistically, Paul?
Well, I think I mentioned it. If you had even a basic engine monitor like a JPI, you've got CHT. And CHT is the determining factor here for engine temperature. It's not oil temperature. And if the CHTs were normal and the oil temperature indicates high, then I see that as less of a problem. If the CHTs are high, and by high, I mean for a Lycoming, 320 and above in a carbureted Lycoming is getting high. Otherwise, they're going to run in the 280s and 290s most of the time in cool weather. So if the CHTs are getting high, that would change my decision making. But if they were normal, it would just reinforce what I already thought.
Yeah, an engine monitor in this situation would be invaluable.
Sure. Another thing that you mentioned in your response, Paul, is that there are a ton of options continuing ahead. It's like every 15 miles or so, there's another airport. So suppose, you know, you don't have to climb, but there aren't options ahead. You know, you've got the next 80 miles or so, there's not really anywhere to stop. Bruce, does that change it for you?
Well,
you're stopping already anyway.
Well, yeah, but to your point, there are options if you had a real emergency or, you know, a need or a desire to land quickly. There are airports along the route, but not all of them are great places to be stuck for a while if you really did have a problem. So Tacoma happens to be a towered airport with services, with a restaurant. That's a good choice. But some of the others along the route would be certainly suitable to land at, but now you're really stuck. So that's one of the reasons why going back to Boeing Field or choosing Tacoma makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, Steve, you're continuing on. Does it make a difference to you that if there weren't good airports ahead?
If there weren't good airports ahead, I'm at Tacoma. And even if there are fields, other land out spots, I want to begin and end my flight at an airport. If there weren't good airport land, you know, other landing options, I would probably put it down at Tacoma and would back off my choice of four somewhere closest airport and get the situation resolved. I don't want to be up there wishing I was down here.
Yeah. So even as a glider guy, airports at both ends is part of the plan.
Especially as glider guy, you're out doing, you know, engine failure and, you know, they'll pull the power downwind to beamers. Oh, you're a glider guy. This should be easy. It's like, no, this is not a glider. It's a 182 with a 9-to-1 glide ratio. Especially as a glider guy, I would, you know, if there aren't, you know, a chain of airports on the way that are either mostly or entirely within my four-flight guide ring, I am putting it down and getting it resolved.
Bruce?
Just one other thing about the alternate situation or airports along the route. This is a good opportunity to think about during your pre-flight planning, more than just, you know, oh, there's an airport along the way, but actually look, it's so easy now with tools like 4Flight to look at the airports that you would be near and say, oh, if something happened, if my passengers, you know, got upset stomachs or otherwise needed to land, you know, where could I go that would be the best places to go that are along or near my route? So just take a few moments during your pre-flight planning to ask, okay, along this route, there's X airports I could use in an emergency, but there's also some airports that might be good stops if we needed to stop for some other reason.
Wally.
Yeah, in answer to your question, I think if there were no airports along the way as a 50-hour pilot, I probably would just return to Boeing Field. And you can either leave the airplane there or get it looked at and make a decision. I want to comment in Paul's answer. He talked about the procedure of lean a peak would actually cools cylinders. And that's for sure correct. But unless you have the instrumentation that would allow you to do that and you've had the training to do it properly, it could very possibly get a pilot in more trouble. They should have tried that unless they understand it and have the instrumentation that allows it to be done correctly.
Well, you would turn back as this pilot with 50 hours. What about as yourself with like three orders of magnitude more than that?
I'd keep going. It's not fair because I'm informed by an airplane I used to own called a Cessna 195. And that airplane, you measured the oil on the dipstick in gallons, not in quarts. It had a hard problem keeping the oil cool. And that airplane would take off and climb to about 2,000 feet, and then I'd have to level off and cruise for about 5 minutes to allow the oil temperature to come down off the red line and get in the green. Then I could continue climb again for a couple thousand feet and sort of step climb my way up till I got into cool enough air where I could continue a climb. So I've spent a lot of time juggling airspeed and oil temperature, so it's kind of a natural thing in my case.
Yeah, stagger wing is just the same, Wally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an abnormal thing to be monitoring engine temperature in a climb. I mean, it's usually CHTs that you're dealing with, but any higher performance airplane, a tightly cowled plane, you're going to be thinking about keeping CHTs in the normal range. Oil temp is usually not the first thing you look at there, but here that's all we got. So, Dave?
Yeah, another thing that this pilot has going for him on this route is low elevations. You know, if they had to continue a climb to clear a mountain pass, for example, that would influence the decision. You know, that would probably lead to make me more inclined to turn around. But in this situation with the low elevations and the fact that the pilot could stay at his current altitude and continue the entire trip as is, you know, that would, you know, support the continue faction.
Yeah, so same scenario, except you're going east across the Cascades here. You're out.
Correct.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the fact that people will change their answers here based on the options ahead and the need to climb and all that does speak to, I think, that, you know, you're all not completely confident that there's nothing wrong here, right? So there is sort of a gray area. There's a boundary between okay and not okay. There's, you know, Paul's talking about these fuzzy decisions and the whole hopeful risk calculation. And I want to go back to something you said, Dave, that you've got to become comfortable being uncomfortable. And if you're constantly out there, you know, improving as a pilot and pushing your comfort zone, like we all want to do, that becomes, as you say, a normal state of affairs. And it'd be easy to look at the scenario and say, this is a pilot who is a, you know, it's a brand new pilot. They don't know what they're doing. This doesn't relate to me. But I think any pilot who is pushing their boundaries like that and improving is going to find themselves in these sorts of situations with these sorts of feelings more frequently.